Thank you. If you're wondering what I'm doing, I'm just pegging my talk to the lectern, because just in case of the wind. Can you hear me, Greenbelt? Yes, we can, I think, is the appropriate response. Can you hear me, Greenbelt? Yes, wonderful, wonderful. Well, good evening, faithful few. And what a privilege to talk to the most dedicated of Greenbelters, those who truly kept Monday special. I have to say, I was a bit downhearted when I found out that I was speaking very last thing on the Monday. And I said as much to my wife. And she said, "You're not on last, darling. Think about it. If you were a band, you'd be the headline act." Now, I was cheered for a few minutes, and then I remembered, but darling, I'm not a band. I'm doing a talk. Now, my wife has an answer for everything, and she said, well, Rob Bell is speaking this year. He's really popular. Lots of people will have queued to see him and not got in. And really, you look quite a lot like Rob Bell. Obviously, you're shorter, fatter, balder, and less charismatic than Rob Bell. But maybe some people will come out of pity, so thank you for coming. As you can see, the Holy Spirit has blessed my wife with a gift of encouragement. So thanks for coming, whether it's out of pity, by mistake, or just because I put the word Obama in the title of the talk. Barack Obama's election as president of the USA has been accompanied by the greatest hope and the greatest hype, certainly in my living memory. And I'm sure that many of you were, like me, captivated by the story of his campaign as it gathered momentum from unknown to outsider to Democratic Party nominee to presidential candidate to president of the USA. Obama's twin themes are the audacity of hope and change that we can believe in. For me, for us, those are exciting and inspiring themes. Indeed, for any Christian who believes that a commitment to social justice and a calling to live out our faith in the public square is integral. For us here at Greenbelt, then, Obama's election should offer both hope and inspiration. My argument, and this is an argument, trust me, is that the question we should be asking is not, where is our Obama? It's much more fundamental than that. It's whether that we believe that churches can make political change in our communities. How can we organize our communities with others to pursue social justice and the common good without being hijacked by party political agendas? And how can we avoid the seduction of single issues and seek the common good on the range of concerns that affect our communities? I believe that churches can and should be a focus for local political action through community organizing. And I know that community organizing works. It worked for Barack Obama when he's a community organizer in Chicago in the 1980s. And as a community organizer with the Citizen Organizing Foundation in the UK, I know that it works here too. My job is to build alliances of faith and non-faith organizations to campaign and make change in our communities. So this talk will look at how churches and other faith institutions affiliated to the Citizen Organizing Foundation in the UK are using the same techniques as Obama to organize for change we can believe in. And they've had success, from persuading major corporations to pay a living wage to the poorest people in London, to convincing Boris Johnson to back a regularization for vulnerable migrants. I want to tell the story of how ordinary church folk have organized their communities to take on the scandal of the UK's asylum system, how they've run their own national inquiry and negotiated for change to the way that people seeking sanctuary in the UK are treated. And guess what? They achieved that change that they could see and believe in, and they didn't write a single postcard to their MP. They didn't attend a parliamentary lobby, and they didn't ask their MP to sign early day motion 5,431. They made real change, and they add a whole heap of fun into this bargain. And when I come to the end of this talk, I'm going to finish with a challenge. I warn you, it's going to be very un-Greenbelt, because I'm going to preach. I'm going to tell you that you should do something, because you can't be wishy-washy and liberal about change you can believe in. For those of us who care about politics in the UK, Barack Obama poses us a problem. The main problem is that Barack Obama is American. So while President Obama fights a monumental ideological crusade to introduce universal healthcare in the States, here in the UK, our politics is fixated over whether our MPs can use their expense accounts for widescreen TVs or £1,500 duck houses. And while change may well be on the horizon after next year's election, will it be change we can believe in? Or will it be just another change in government? Because whatever you may think of him, David Cameron is not the British Obama. And I have to say, it's cold comfort to most of the communities that I work with that next June, the chief deck chair rearranger on the Titanic of our political system will have had a more privileged background than the guy they just turfed out. So returning to Obama, along with the audacity of hope came the audacity of hype. There has been no shortage of commentators queuing up to offer their own explanations of the Obama phenomenon. His victory is explained by his campaign's use of technology, by his colour, even, bizarrely, by the portrayal of credible black presidents in popular TV shows like The West Wing and 24. But the struggle to interpret what Obama means for us in the UK, 8 months after his inauguration, has somewhat floundered. Where is the British Obama? We can't see one anywhere in our national politics. And the other explanations for his success seem to have little or no application to the UK. So the temptation for us is to return to our old habits. Now, I don't know about you, but certainly in the darkest days of the Bush presidency, I found solace in Jed Bartlett's fictitious and benignly liberal presidency in The West Wing. And we risk doing the same now. We commodify Obama by reading his books, or we admire the rhetoric of his speeches from a distance. At most, we might even allow ourselves to cheer from the transatlantic sidelines as Obama is forced to defend our beloved NHS, besmirched by Republicans in the fight over universal healthcare. But be warned. To expend our personal, our precious political power on DVD box sets or reading the international section of The Independent is dangerously self-indulgent, particularly for Christians. Those who look for the British Obama do not understand who Obama is or what made him. Here is a man who fights political idolatry, who seeks to build power from the bottom up, for communities to take back the power to solve their own problems. And yet our response so often is to worship him and seek our own political messiah on this side of the pond. Listen to what Barack Obama says in his memoirs, Dreams from My Father, that he published first in 1995. He says, change won't come from the top. Change will come from a mobilized grassroots. What if a politician would see his job as that of an organizer, as part teacher and part advocate, one who does not sell voters short, but who educates them about the real choices before them? He concludes, we must form grassroots structures that would hold me and other elected officials more accountable for their actions. And you saw this in the presidential race. Voters in the States were offered a choice. They could vote for Hillary Clinton, who invited voters to elect her so that she could fix the country for them. In contrast, Obama invited people to vote for him to demonstrate the power of people to fix the country for themselves. So those who say the answer is to find our own Obama are like the crowd in Monty Python's The Life of Brian. Has anybody seen that film? Yeah? Convinced that Brian is the Messiah, they track him down to his mother's house where he's been up to something rather naughty. He flings open the window in the morning and the crowd begins to hail him as the Messiah. And Brian says, look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals. And the crowd, of course, replies in unison, yes, we're all individuals. And Brian says, you're all different. And the crowd replies in unison, yes, we're all different. And then one man says, I'm not. And the rest of the crowd says, shut up. In the film, Brian's mother appears and says, he's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. And similarly, those who know Obama best know that he is not the Messiah. Michelle Obama, his wife, has said, Barack is not a politician, first and foremost. He's a community activist exploring the viability of politics to make change. So he may not be our political Messiah, but in his commitment to community action, he does point the way to a political nirvana, to a method of political agency that allows citizens and communities to act together across boundaries of race, boundaries of religion, boundaries of class, to move the world as it is, with all of its injustices and tragedies, towards the world as it should be. Now, for us as Christians, that's about moving our communities one step nearer to the kingdom of God. Well, what is this nirvana of which I speak? We call it community organizing, and it's the key to understanding the Obama phenomenon. Obama's experience as a community organizer, agitating and training faith communities to work together for the common good on the streets of Chicago in the 1980s, was his single foremost political experience. And he said as much during the election campaign. He said, I will never forget that my journey began on the streets of Chicago. Those 3 years were the best education I ever had. It was what he learned as a community organizer that helped him make an authentic connection with the lives of ordinary Americans, that he was then able to communicate to the wider electorate. He touched people. He touched us in a different nation. Chicago had helped him to understand and articulate what it means to value the experience and aspirations of people, of communities, and of faith. And it was community organizing that helped him to understand the power of many people organized together, inspired with hope rather than fear, and desperate for meaningful change. Now, for those of you who followed the election, community organizing rose to prominence in the presidential race when Sarah Palin, remember her, contrasted her experience of governing the state of Alaska with Obama's 3 years as a community organizer in Chicago, in effect suggesting that this was insufficient experience for him to govern the USA. And this brought the community organizing model into sharp focus, forcing Obama to say, community organizing tells you who I am and why I'm in this race and who I am fighting for. And in fact, after that, there was a strong anti-Palin backlash. And as a result, if you go on the internet, you can now buy bumper stickers that read, Jesus was a community organizer, Pontius Pilate was a governor. So what is community organizing? It began in the United States with the work of a radical academic and hellraiser. And he really was. His name was Saul Alinsky. And he began organizing in the slums of Chicago in the 1930s. Alinsky's insight was that in a world with large globalizing corporations and a growing state, where elected representatives were increasingly distant from the people they represented, well, then there was a need for civil society to be better organized. And they needed to be better organized in order to hold the state and the market to account for the decisions that they make that affect the people who live in our communities. Now, Alinsky knew that the only force that could stand up to the power of organized money was the power of organized people. And so he sought to create organizations of organizations that could work together to tackle local issues. In his seminal work, Rules for Radicals, if you want a rollicking good read of about 180 pages about how to do community action, read Rules for Radicals. It's a bit like, then read some of the newer stuff as well, because it's a bit like just reading, becoming a Christian and then only reading the Old Testament. You need to read the New Testament too. But there's some fantastic stuff there. In Rules for Radicals, Alinsky explains community organizing thus. He says, "We are concerned with how to create mass organizations to seize power and give it to the people, to realize the democratic dream of equality, justice, peace, cooperation, equal and full opportunities for education, full and useful employment, health, and the creation of circumstances in which man can have the chance to live by values that give meaning to life. We are talking about a mass power organization which will change the world into a place where all men and women walk erect, in the spirit of the credo that it's better to die on your feet than to live on your knees." That's pretty stirring stuff. Rather than recruit individual activists, Alinsky sought to involve existing organizations that had a stake in their local community and a vision of a better world. And naturally, faith organizations were obvious targets. And when Alinsky organized the Back of Yards in Chicago, 80% of the member organizations were Catholic. Alinsky's methodology was based on the idea that you needed to unite local organizations around power and self-interest, rather than around altruism and a particular issue. He said, "In a multiple issue organization, each person is saying to the other, I can't get what I want alone, and neither can you. Let's make a deal. I'll support you for what you want, and you support me for what I want. This deal becomes the program." I saw this for myself. Last month, I ran a workshop for 40 Somali women in East London. We're starting to organize the Somali community because if any community needs more power, it's Somali women. They're amongst the most marginalized and vulnerable of any community in our country. The women we met with had two issues they wanted to resolve. Firstly, access to English language classes locally. And secondly, a ban on a drug called CAT, which is blighting their community. Now, some issues are small and can be solved by that community. And to demonstrate this, in this workshop, I moved a table to the middle of the room. And I told them to imagine that the table was their issue of access to English language classes. And in order to solve that issue, they needed to move the table across the room. And I challenged them, which one of you wants to solve this problem for yourself? And one lone Somali lady got up and tried to move the table. And of course, it's a heavy table and she couldn't do it. And I said, who else wants to solve this issue? And five more Somali women got up. They organized themselves. I didn't need any interference from me around that table. And they moved that table. They solved that issue. Those Somali women working together can solve that problem that faces that community. But then I summoned a small girl who one of the mothers had brought to come to the front and to sit on the table. And next to her, I asked my 6-foot-tall Somali organizer to also sit on the table. And I said, this is your problem of this drug CAT, which is blighting your community. It is much bigger. Who wants to solve that one? To solve this, you need to move this table and these people across this room. And four Somali women came up and said, I will do this. And they got up and they arranged themselves around the table and they tried to lift and they couldn't do it. They didn't have the power, the ability to act to make that change. And it was at that point that a group of Jewish young men who'd been sitting observing the session came forward and said, we will help. We will help you move this. And they came forward and they arranged themselves around with these Somali women. And so there you had it. Somali women, Jewish men, Jew and Muslim, British and Somali, male and female, together they had the power to move that table. Only in alliance with others can any of our communities solve the bigger questions that affect us. Alinsky knew this, but he also knew that it wasn't good enough just to run our own charitable programs. We had to hold the state and the market to account for the changes and decisions they make that affect our communities. And he realized that the only way that we could do this The only way that he could hold these people to account is to mobilize lots of people and to use their bodies to make change. Now, I have to tell you, the potential for organized people to use their bodies in a political way is boundless. It is fun, and it's terrifying for the authorities. I'll give you an example, a very famous story about Saul Alinsky. He was invited to Rochester in New York to organize among the black churches there. This was in the 60s. The town was dominated by the photographic giant Kodak, who treated the black community there very poorly. Now, the previous year, there'd been bloody riots, and the National Guard had been drafted in. It was described, that town, at that time, as a huge southern slave plantation transplanted north. And when asked to comment on what Kodak had done for the black community, Alinsky told journalists that, as far as he was aware, the only thing Kodak has done on the race issue in America is to introduce color film. Well, despite protest, strike, and riot, and the intervention of supportive white liberals in the town, Kodak refused to recognize a trade union or to meet with black representatives. So Alinsky encouraged workers to use their body as a tactic to force the management to negotiate with them. And this is what he suggested. He said, we've got to hit them where it really hurts. Now, Rochester was proud of its liberal arts program. It had a huge symphony hall and a very, very famous kind of equivalent to the proms every summer, a whole series of concerts, mostly patronized by the white middle-class management of Kodak. Kodak sponsored the event and had helped build that symphony hall. So what Alinsky suggested was that they should buy 100 tickets to the opening concert, that 100 black men, workers at Kodak, who wanted to be recognized, should dress up in their Sunday best and go along to that concert, sit there and enjoy it. But before that, they would go to a church hall and they would eat a 3-hour feast of baked beans. They would then go to the symphony hall and let nature take its course. And Alinsky reckoned that basically, you know, the symphony would be over by the time of the first movement. Now, sadly for us, they never had to do that. They used another tactic. But it's a good example of how a group in a town who felt powerless were able to use a tactic to make change. There's another example that Alinsky used in one of his community organizations in Chicago, where they did use the threat of a similar action that every Greenbelter will appreciate. Now, what happened was, this was in Chicago, and one of Alinsky's community organizations had done a deal with the mayor at City Hall about what they wanted for their communities. And about 6 months after the mayor had promised to do something, he reneged, he backed down on that deal. And whenever Alinsky and his leaders called City Hall, nobody would return their calls. And so this is what they decided to do. The most important thing for the economy of Chicago at that time was O'Hare Airport. Okay? And O'Hare Airport only had a certain number of toilets. And Alinsky reckoned that basically they could cause chaos in that airport, because in those days, you go on a plane, you know, you'd wait for your in-flight meal and you drink, and then you think, oh, I'll go to the loo now. But then loads of people would have occupied it, and their trays would be up, and it'd be very difficult for you to reach it. And in the end, you'd say, well, I'll just hang on until I get to the airport. And then you'd see people rush out and grab the nearest loo. So what these guys threatened to do was to go down in force and occupy every single toilet cubicle in O'Hare Airport. They went out and worked out how many urinals there were in the gents' toilets, and they took down lots of books and magazines and newspapers. They paid their dime, and they occupied those toilets for an entire day, perfectly legally. And of course, they couldn't stand in front of the cubicles the whole time, but they would have 20 or 30 people waiting on the concourse, and whenever a flight came in, they would rush in and occupy and have a queue 3 or 4 deep to occupy every urinal. Now, they never actually had to do that because they leaked that to the local media and it got through to City Hall. And let me tell you, within 12 hours, they had a meeting with the mayor and he'd agreed to give them everything that they'd asked for. Now, by the time that Obama became a community organizer in Chicago in the 1980s. Alinsky had died, and his mantle had been picked up by Ed Chambers, who, with a team of talented organizers, they refined Alinsky's methods and put the focus on building permanent alliances that could exert long-term influence in their communities under the banner of something called the Industrial Areas Foundation. Now, the organization Obama joined, the Developing Communities Project, believed in the Alinsky community organizing tradition. They believed in public confrontations, but also in instilling in people the belief that they had the power to redefine their own lives, both through activism and personal behavior. Obama's project was fighting not just the entrenched power of whiteness and wealth, which was still extraordinarily strong in post-civil rights Chicago, but they were also fighting a lack of public money and the demoralization of its own members. And I think in many ways we can perhaps all relate to that today. So what did Obama do in Chicago? Well, community organizers do not jump into a situation and start bossing people around. They begin by listening, debating, cajoling, inspiring, and delegating. They are less deciders than ralliers. Community organizers explain the options. They inspire self-confidence and try to empower others and not themselves. And if you think of Obama, even on the global stage as president, this is still his creed. Community organizers do not tell you to expect instant results. It takes time when you try to build real change from below. But the change is stronger, the change is deeper, and the change is more real. And if you read the Chicago chapters of Dreams from My Father, which is Obama's memoirs, you will read the ups and downs of a community organizer. You see, on the plus side, victories such as removing asbestos from the rundown housing project that he was working on. And on the minus, that community's continued to decline. Well, to bring us up to date, the Industrial Areas Foundation is still going strong today. They teach a radical lesson that civil society needs to build power if it is to make change. And so the IAF builds organizations whose primary purpose is power, which we define simply as the ability to act. It is neither a positive nor a negative thing. It is simply the ability to act. And the chief product of power is social change. In fact, it is essential. Let me tell you, placards on their own do not bring change. Marches do not bring change. Writing postcards to your MP does not bring change. Those are all tools that can build your power sometimes. But you need the power to make the change. And that's what we do in community organizing. Community organizations under the IAF are non-ideological and they're strictly non-partisan, but they are proudly, they're publicly, and they're persistently political. And they build a political base within civil society to challenge and influence the decisions made by business and government. And let me tell you, it works. The Industrial Areas Foundation in the States has an impressive track record of winning campaigns, for example, on the level of wages for low-paid workers, providing decent, affordable housing in the inner cities, and improving the quality of education in inner city schools. Well, in the United States, community organizing has a 70-year history, and it's estimated that there are some 10,000 community organizers operating there. By contrast, in the United Kingdom, community organizing's only been operating for 20 years, and we've got about 20 organizers, of which I'm one. The Citizen Organizing Foundation is a registered charity affiliated to the American Industrial Areas Foundation, and it is the umbrella body for community organizing in the UK. COF's mission is to create a network of competent, informed, and organized citizens who act responsibly in the public life of their communities and are able to influence, for the common good, not sectional interest, for the common good, decisions which impact on their communities. Now, COF does this through the creation of broad-based organizations, diverse alliances of local civil society organizations. What I'm talking about are churches and mosques and schools and trade unions and refugee organizations. They affiliate to the COF and they agree to work together. These broad-based organizations engage in a series of campaigns at local, regional, and occasionally national level on issues which their members have identified as being important to their communities. Now, COF works with three broad-based organisations in the UK. The oldest and most famous is called Telco, or East London Citizens. But there's also South London Citizens and West London Citizens. Collectively and imaginatively, these are known as London Citizens. There's a North London Citizens, which is coming online soon, and Oxford Citizens and Milton Keynes Citizens are in the pipeline. And for those of you outside of those areas, there are 19 developing campaign action teams, which we hope will become the seeds for broad-based organisations across the country in 19 cities now across the UK. It is these broad-based organisations, already dominated by faith institutions, that offer the single greatest opportunity for churches to create change we can believe in. So I'm going to share with you three stories of how community organising works in practice. I guess you've got a couple of questions, and there'll be a time for questions later on. But the first question I'd be asking is, well, can organised faith communities really take on banks and big business and win? The answer is, yes, we can. In Telco, East London Citizens, a group of leaders from faith communities got together to talk about what the main issues were that affected the people who went to their churches and their mosques and their schools. And they said the big problem for us in East London is poverty. Poverty is our problem. But the problem with poverty is that it's so big, so intangible. What is the solution to poverty? There isn't a single one. There are lots. And that makes it very difficult to campaign around. And so they cut that problem into an issue. And the issue they looked at, which they saw as one of the biggest causes of poverty in their communities, was low wages. There were people in their churches and in their mosques who were being paid so poorly that they were unable to sustain a basic standard of living in inner city London. And it was having an impact not only on the lives of those people, but also on the strength of those institutions. People weren't able to give as much time to their church to volunteer. They weren't able to give as much money in the collection. The numbers of people who turned out on a Sunday or for Friday prayers had gone down because people were working so much in order to scratch a basic living. And so they came up with a solution. Something we always do in community organizing is come up with a solution. And the solution to low wages for people in London was something called the living wage. Who here has heard about the living wage? Anybody? Great, some of you. The living wage was created by London Citizens. They commissioned academics to look into what was needed, how much did you need to earn per hour in order to have a very basic standard of living in London. And they found that the minimum wage wasn't enough. The minimum wage in London is essentially a poverty wage. And so they came up with this idea of a living wage, which was calculated, and it's about £2 more an hour than the minimum wages. And they said, well, okay, we've got our solution. How do we make change happen? So they said, let's focus on some targets. Let's find out where there are lots of people who are being paid the minimum wage, where they're being paid poverty wages in London. So they said, let's start small. Let's start with HSBC in Canary Wharf. Huge, huge building in Canary Wharf. They found out that the cleaners there were being paid the minimum wage. And they began by seeking negotiation with Sir John Bond, who's the chair of HSBC at that time. They wanted to talk to him about whether they could pay at HSBC a living wage. And so they wrote him a letter. And of course, he didn't respond. So they wrote him another letter. And they didn't get a response this time either. So they called up, and this time they did get a letter back saying, thanks, but no thanks. So that's when Citizens did what Citizens do best, and that is radical, non-violent, creative, direct action. And what they did was they used the power of their own institutions, which included lots of Catholic churches at that time. Now, for any of you who are from Catholic churches or even from some Anglican churches, you'll know that there'll be a place where you can go and light a candle for somebody and say a prayer. And then you can drop 20p in a box. And what would normally happen is that those churches would take those boxes of money into their local bank at a quiet time of the week. And they'd get the money changed or paid into their account. What they did, though, as an alliance, was about a dozen of those churches saved all of those boxes of cash up. They saved up all their small change and their collection takings up for several months. And then they went to the flagship HSBC bank in Oxford Street at the busiest time of the busiest day of the busiest week of the financial year for them, just in the run-up to Christmas. And they asked for all that money to be changed at once. While they were doing this, we had nuns queuing up, and when a cashier became available, the nun would open a bank account at HSBC. And then they go to the back of the queue, and they close the bank account with HSBC. And they go to the back of the queue, and they'd open the bank account again, and so on. We had people at the cash machines putting in their cards, checking their balance, taking the cards out, and going to the back of the queue again. As you can imagine, there was chaos. But we made it very clear to the manager, look, we don't want to be here. We will leave just as soon as you pick up the phone, call Sir John Bond or your head office, and get us a meeting so we can talk about the living wage. And he did pick up the phone, and he called the police. And the next thing you know, blue flashing lights, brakes screeching, the coppers pile in. Hello, 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 what's going on here? I'm stereotyping, they didn't actually say that. What's happening here? And the bank manager says, it's terrible. We've got people here. They're changing money and they're opening and closing bank accounts. And the policeman looked at him and said, this is a bank, isn't it? Well, sadly, although that got us recognition, it didn't get the meeting with Sir John Bond, but we're persistent. And so we knew we needed to do something more to get into relationship with him. And so what we did was we bought enough shares in HSBC to be able to go along to their annual shareholder meeting. And we took with us some of our leaders from Telco, leaders of the local Catholic churches, a Methodist leader, and someone from the mosque. And we also took with us Abdul, who went to the local mosque in East London, but who also happened to be one of the cleaners at HSBC. And those guys got up in the middle of that meeting and very courteously just said, excuse me, Sir John Bond was chairing, we hate to interrupt your meeting, but we as shareholders and as London citizens think that other people here will be very concerned by the poverty wages that you are paying cleaners here. And Abdul here would just like to share a few words. And Abdul got up very bravely and said, Sir John, it's a privilege for me to clean your office. But you have to know what the consequences of your poverty wages have on me and my family. I have to work two jobs. I'm working ridiculous numbers of hours a week in order just so that we can scrape by. We don't get a holiday. I'm unable to work, give time at the mosque for voluntary work anymore because I'm working so often. I'm exhausted. I don't spend time with my kids. I can't even send my kid on the school trip. And Abdul sat down. And one of the other leaders got up and said, Sir John, all we are asking for is for you to meet with us, meet with London citizens, to talk about paying a living wage. Well, what could Sir John Bond do? Obviously, we tipped off all the financial journalists who were there pen in hand, waiting to see what his response would be. He gave us a meeting. And after that point, we got into negotiation, fruitful negotiation with Sir John Bond. And it took time, but to cut a long story short, HSBC ended up paying the living wage to their cleaners and their security staff. The story doesn't end there. After HSBC, Barclays, KPMG, Queen Mary University, the London School of Economics, some NHS hospitals, the Tate Modern, all followed suit. In the past couple of years, the living wage has put £24 million into the back pockets of some of the poorest paid people in London. £24 million extra. That's change you can believe in. Change with people of faith at its core. Change that you should be a part of. Okay, so that's business. But can organised faith communities hold our elected politicians to account? Well, yes, we can. For those of you who live in London, you'll know that we had a mayoral election last year. During that campaign, pretty much every day of that campaign, some organisation held a hustings event where the candidates all trooped off, got to make a speech, and were then asked some questions. We didn't do that. Instead of holding a hustings, London citizens held an accountability assembly. For 6 months in the run-up to that election, we held a listening campaign in our churches to find out what were the real issues that affected people in our communities. And we then channeled those through our team of leaders into a coherent set of policy asks. And then instead of holding a hustings where we got spoken at by a load of politicians and then possibly got to ask a couple of questions at the end, we booked out Methodist Central Hall. We filled it with 2,000 people from our alliance across London, from churches, mosques, schools, trade unions, refugee organisations. Our leaders set out our agenda to the politicians, who were all there listening, and then they were asked, one by one, point by point, this is what we as an alliance are asking for. Will you back this, yes or no? Will you work with us to make London a better place? And do you know what? Boris Johnson said during that debate, it was the most intimidating atmosphere he'd ever been in. Not because we were nasty, it was a very mature, there was no, very little, you know, we weren't barracking or heckling. But having 2,000 organised citizens there, who he knew, and the other candidates knew, represented thousands of other people in their churches and mosques and schools and trade unions, who also cared about these issues, that was where the power lay. And you know what? Boris Johnson, Ken Livingstone, Brian Paddock and the other candidates signed up to pretty much all of the many asks that we made. They agreed to expand the living wage. They agreed to keep a living wage unit at City Hall to make sure that the living wage kept on being recalculated so that it would go up as it needed to go up year after year. They agreed to back a campaign called City Safe, which is about using citizen and community initiatives to tackle knife crime and make our community safer for our young people. And most controversially of all, they backed a regularisation and earned amnesty for irregular migrants who were living in our communities and have been in the UK for a number of years. Persuading a Conservative mayor to expand the living wage and publicly back a regularisation for undocumented migrants, that's change you can believe in. That's change with people of faith at its core. That's change you should be a part of. Finally, can organised faith communities take on the government and win? Yes, we can. In 2004, a group of mostly churches in South London citizens got together to talk about the issues that affected their communities. And the issue that came up time and time again was Luna House. Luna House is in Croydon, and it's the headquarters of the Home Office's border agency. It's basically where asylum applications and visa applications get dealt with. And person after person got up and shared their testimony of how they'd been treated really badly at Luna House. They'd been kept waiting for months on end. They'd submitted their papers and hadn't heard anything. Files had been mislaid. Staff had been rude to them. They were completely at a loss as to what to do. And that's the beauty of community organising. It gives you somewhere to go, because let's face it, having a bunch of people moaning together in a church hall about the issues in their community, that's not unusual. What is unusual is then going and doing something about it, something effective. And they realised that if they were to go and complain about these issues, the border agency wouldn't listen. So they set up their own commission, a commission of inquiry into Luna House. They got the great and the good to gather testimony, to hear evidence, and then to produce a report that would make recommendations for reform. But they wanted to negotiate and be in dialogue with the people in power, because the people who ran Luna House, because many of the people in our congregations actually worked there, and we knew that it wasn't a barrel of laughs for them either. So we wrote to the border agency and asked whether they would meet, and it was a familiar pattern. They didn't respond. And then we wrote again, and they didn't respond. And we phoned, and they sent us a letter saying, thanks, but no thanks. government set up inquiries, not citizens. Well, what happened after that was we again took radical action. We hired a camper van. We parked it in Luna House car park. We staffed it with nuns. And then we did that most radical of campaigning acts. We served tea and coffee to people who walked through. And you might say, and with some justification, what on earth is the point of doing that? Well, it did two things. The first thing was that the border agency said you can under no circumstances talk to our staff about what it's like to live, to work at Luna House. And so what we did is whenever we handed out a tea or coffee, we asked people to fill in a questionnaire. And we gathered quite a lot of evidence about what life was like at Luna House. But secondly, it really hacked them off. They tried to ignore us. They thought we would go away. And here we were in their car park with a camper van over several days with some nuns. And they weren't too keen on this. And so they did think about getting rid of us. And frankly, they would have been in the right. We had no right to be there. Legally, they could have said, be gone. But they made a calculation. And their calculation was that they didn't really want to have pictures of their burly security guards forcibly evicting a bunch of nuns from their car park, splashed all over the front page of the local press. And so they were forced, not by anything coercive that we did, but they were forced by our action and by the use of our bodies and our very presence there to negotiate. And after that, those citizens brought change to Luna House. And after they'd done that through negotiation, they set up an inquiry into the entire asylum system across the UK, which reported last year and got national coverage. And now Citizens for Sanctuary, which is the campaign I run, based at the Citizen Organising Foundation and designed to implement those recommendations through community organising, is training teams of citizens across our country with faith communities at their core once again to make change, to implement those recommendations. So taking on the mighty Home Office and winning better treatment for people seeking sanctuary, that's change you can believe in. Change with people of faith at its core, change that you should be a part of. And if you want to find out more about London Citizens and the Citizen Organising Foundation and any of these 19 Citizens for Sanctuary campaign action teams across the UK, then you can look them up at www.londoncitizens.org.uk, or you can speak to me afterwards. I'll be hanging around for a bit. Or come and get one of these booklets. It's part of our Citizens for Sanctuary campaign. It's called 10 Ways for Citizens to Save Sanctuary. And they're free. I've got a whole box of them. I don't really want to take any of them home. So come and take them. They're quite fun. So here's where I get preachy. I don't need to quote texts or theology. Some of you will know that what I'm about to say is right because of your reading of Matthew. Others because of your reading of Luke or the Beatitudes. Others of Paul, of the Hebrew scriptures, or of Catholic social teaching. And our alliances are full of Catholics, Anglicans, Methodists, Evangelicals, Pentecostals, and people of other faith, and none. They all have their different reasons for taking action, but their commitment to each other and to the common good of their community is the same, and it binds them together. If you don't believe me, let Obama's words challenge you. These are words from The Audacity of Hope. He says, no one is exempt from the call to find common ground. A sense of mutual understanding is not enough. After all, talk is cheap. Like any value, empathy must be acted upon. When I was a community organizer in the 80s, I would often challenge neighborhood leaders by asking them where they put their time, where they put their energy, where they put their money. Those are the true tests of what we value, regardless of what we tell ourselves. If we aren't willing to pay a price for our values, if we aren't willing to make sacrifices in order to realize them, then we should ask ourselves whether we truly believe in them at all. So that's the question I ask you to take home with you. I don't care if you're not clergy. I don't care if you're not part of your church's leadership team. If you are a follower of Jesus, if you are a member of a church, well, then you have a voice and you have responsibility. As you travel home tonight or lie awake in your tent, I want you to ask yourself those same questions that Obama asked. Where do I put my time? Where do I put my energy? Where do I put my money? And unless you already live in the world as it should be, unless the community in which you live is free of poverty, free of injustice, free of division, free of hatred, free of want, free of fear, unless for you and your community the kingdom has come, well then your church, your community, you need to organize for change you can believe in. And until you organize, until you join with others and take back the power to change your communities for the common good, well, the harsh truth is that your social welfare programs will only ever apply a sticking plaster to a bullet wound. Your charitable contributions will only ever be an ever smaller drop in a swelling ocean of human misery. And you and your church will lose relevance even to the needy of your parishes, who in the past looked to you to pick up the pieces when the actions of the powerful crushed their hopes and their aspirations. So you need to organize your communities. If you're in London, make it your first action when you leave here for your church to join London Citizens. If you're not in London, join one of the 19 Citizens for Sanctuary action teams across the country. Call up the Citizen Organizing Foundation and find out if there are plans for a broad-based organization in your area. If there aren't, find out how to start one yourself. Go to the States, see how it's done there. Even, I don't know, become an organizer. And ask yourself, what have I learnt from Obama? Can I give up the pleasing fantasy of finding the British Obama who can fix all our problems for us? Can we work together and organize as churches to act politically? Can we be at the heart of real and lasting social change in our communities? Can we begin to fix our community's problems for ourselves? And ask yourself, how can I? How can my church? How can my community? How can we be a part of this? Obama holds out a three-word message of hope and inspiration to us. Yes, we can. Yes, we can change. Yes, we can. So go from here. Be sent. Organize. Don't wait for others. You are the ones who can bring change we can believe in. Thank you. You're very kind. We've got time for some questions if people want to come to the front. We've got one coming. Any more for any more? We don't want to make him feel lonely. It's a long walk across there.
Get nice and close to the microphone, please. That would be helpful.
In the wages campaign with the HSBC, were those workers in a trade union? Was the trade union involved in that campaign? Because that, to me, being a trade unionist, that would be the logical organisation to campaign in that way.
Okay. Yes, they were. Many union branches are actually part of London Citizens. And part of the reason is because of the Living Wage campaign. One of the problems with a lot of these places is where people are being paid very low wages is that either they're not unionized or the employer is using an agency which is actually hostile to union organizing. In some cases, the unions are organizing there, but they find that alone they don't have the power to make the change they need. And that is why the alliance is so significant. When we won the living wage at Tate Modern, we worked very constructively with the union. The union had been pushing for this for quite a while and hadn't got very far, sadly, and so worked with us. And what we realised is that persuasion alone wasn't going to be enough. Negotiation wasn't going to be enough. And so what we did was we picked a day just before Christmas. I don't know if anybody knows in the Tate Modern, there was that big artwork in the Turbine Hall. It was called, I want to call it Beelzebub, but it wasn't called Beelzebub. But it was basically a massive crack down the middle of the Turbine Hall. And it was supposed to represent the chasm between the rich and the poor. And so what we did is, just before Christmas, we organized with the trade union, and they had a big demonstration just outside the doors of the Tate Modern, with drums and pickets and all this sort of thing. Meanwhile, we turned out about 200 people from our alliance who just drifted unnoticed into the Turbine Hall. And then on cue, because it was the Christmas season, an opera singer sang from the gantry, "Once in Royal David City." And on that cue, all of these 200 citizens, many of them again from faith communities who all knew the carol, obviously, started to sing too and came over the crack and joined hands to represent overcoming the chasm between the rich and the poor. And then we had some banners saying you should pay the living wage. And we got BBC London there, and it was a top story on BBC London, that news. And it really embarrassed the Tate. And it ended up with them paying the living wage. So we work very constructively with unions. Many of them are members. But often unions find that they are not strong enough to make the change alone.
Thank you.
You mentioned the Rules for Radicals book as kind of the Old Testament of community organizing, and you also recommended reading, as it were, the New Testament texts, which presumably include Barack Obama's own books. Do you have any other suggestions for, as it were, the New Testament canon of community organizing?
The problem is that most of these books are written by people in the States, and they're really difficult to get hold of. I don't want to put you off, but when I tried to get the book I'm going to suggest, I ordered it from Amazon in January, and I only got it in May. But you can get hold of them. There are two books I'd recommend. Three. Barack Obama's own book, Dreams from My Father, is particularly good because the whole middle section is about his time as an organizer in Chicago. If you're thinking about becoming a community organizer and you want to know what the ups and downs are like, read that. If you want to know more about community organizing, either as a leader or as a potential organizer, there are two books. One is by a guy called Mike Geeken, and it's called Going Public. And the other is by Ed Chambers, and it's called Roots for Radicals. Roots for Radicals.
Well, thank you for a brilliant talk and inspirational. What keeps you going when it gets a bit tough?
What keeps me going is partly my faith. I do this because I'm a Christian and I believe that we are called to make this kind of change. And so my faith keeps me going. My family, my loving and encouraging wife keep me going. My friends keep me going. But ultimately for me, it's the change. It's seeing change happen. Within 6 weeks in the summer, we organized in the Tees Valley in Middlesbrough and Stockton. At the start of that 6 weeks, we had one issue. The issue is that people seeking sanctuary in the UK, whether they were young, old, had a heart condition, were pregnant or elderly or whatever, were being asked to make a 12-mile round trip on foot in order to comply with border agency regulations. Within 6 weeks, we'd organised, well, the people in Middlesbrough, I'd agitated the people in Middlesbrough to organise a campaign using a community organising technique. They got into negotiation with the regional director of the border agency. From September the 14th, no one will ever have to make that walk from Middlesbrough to Stockton again. That's what keeps me going.
I just wanted to say that I'm part of the Sydney Alliance, which has just started in the last 2 years, and we are still working on building relationships. We haven't got any issue that we're working with yet. But I wanted to just say that there's another benefit from church perspective is the amazing opportunity to build relationships with other people who you're working with, in our case, with unionists and people in community organizations who are not church organizations. And the opportunity to speak about what motivates you and for them to share with you what motivates them. And I think from a Christian perspective, the opportunity to have conversations with others and to realize that you actually have common common motivations and goals. I suppose one could even say there's sometimes an evangelical moment even in those things, but it's a very powerful thing. And certainly some of the conversations I've been in over the last couple of years, I never would have had I not been part of this Sydney Alliance, which as yet I don't know if it's going to work, but I've nevertheless had these amazing conversations, which I think is a side benefit.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And one thing, if you are a priest or a church leader here, the thing you'll be thinking is, well, I really like to do this, but this is just another drain on my time, isn't it? And actually, what the best clergy find who really use organizing is that organizing builds the strength of their institutions because it doesn't rely on just the primary leader. It builds a team of leaders within your congregation who can take action, not just in their community, but then also in the church. So don't go away thinking, oh, this is just another drain, this is another distraction from our core mission.
Hi, obviously, what you're trying to do here is inherently bottom up. But have you found a problem where you can become too popular, too big, and you end up having to become top down almost? So if you look at Obama, he started bottom up. And now in order to continue that work, he's had to centralize a lot of power and almost go against what he started doing. Have you had that problem, and what would you do to prevent that?
I haven't, because I'm not Barack Obama and I'm not standing for election. And that's the difference. I mean, Obama is a community organizer, but he's no longer community organizing. He's a mainstream politician using some of the techniques of organizing. We stick pretty rigidly to a methodology, which means that our campaigns have to come from the authentic experience of our people at a grassroots level. And there are checks and balances, which means it's the leaders from those institutions that run the show. The organizer is in the background. If the organizer is in the foreground too much, you know that organizer is not a good organizer. So yeah, there are checks and balances about how we do that.
In America, there's obviously been a lot of debate about the healthcare reform, and the conservative organizations have been organizing disruptions at the town hall meetings, and I wondered what you thought of that.
Well, what I think about it is, what I think is more interesting perhaps is what Obama has done using community organizing techniques to help him as president. Anybody here, did anybody sign up to get the emails from the Obama campaign during the election period? No? Okay. Oh yeah, he did. You did. Well, you'll know that you get an email about every 3 days asking you to give money or to go to a meeting or whatever. What Obama has done with that alliance of people who got him elected is created something called Organizing for America. What he's trying to do now is build those local grassroots groups across the country to agitate him and to keep him accountable, but also to fight the Republicans and the backlash against the healthcare reform stuff. So I think what's really interesting is how organizing techniques are being used to create essentially a political constituency that can use town hall meetings and other things like that to push these issues forward outside of an election period. My venue manager's disappeared. I think that's the end. I'm hanging around. If anybody wants to talk to me, you're more than welcome to do so. I've got loads of these leaflets, booklets here. Do come and pick one up. They're here. Thank you very much. You've been very generous, and some great questions, and go organize.